What does it mean in Africa? And what does it mean in some of these emerging economies where we see actually wealth and high rates of growth? What we're trying to focus on is if we allow the system to continue in the way it's continuing, those countries will lose critical value they need now to fund their own development. And the end game we seek is actually one in which countries are taking responsibility for their own development by building strong institutions and building a tax system that will fund their citizens' welfare.
What's the real price of tax dodging?
Well, it varies country to country. I think here in
right
here in the United States, I think we estimate that if we close the loopholes through, this, through the Stop Tax Haven Abuse Act, we probably have $220 billion additional dollars that we can invest in the economy over about a 5 to 10 year period.
We're going to continue this conversation. Post online at democracynow.org. Raymond Offenheiser is president of the International Relief and Development Organization, Oxfam America. We'll link to the report it's just put out, An Economy for the 1%, How Privilege and Power in the Economy Drive Extreme Inequality and How This Can Be Stopped. That does it for the broadcast. We have two job openings, a director of finance and operations and a director of development. Go to democracynow.org for more information. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with our host, Joanne Hardesty. Today's guest is Jessica Campbell of the Rural Organizing Project, who will talk about the Burns occupation and the local community response to that occupation. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Milagro Theater, whose new play, Broken Promises, by Olga Sanchez, addresses teen prostitution in Portland. To find out more, you can visit milagro.org.
On Monday, February 15th at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kbooppc@gmail.com, and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
This is Mike Crenshaw.
And Monica Beamer.
We are KBOO station co-managers. We wanted to say thank you to all of our members for helping KBOO to exceed our goals in December. We appreciate everyone's generosity and commitment to KBOO, and we can't do all that we do without you.
We wanted to thank you for helping us to meet our $10,000 one-to-one match for new and increasing donations in November and December. We met our goal. And thank you to all the generous foundations and donors who created the match that encouraged new membership.
We have a lot more to do in 2016, and we can't do it without our members, our volunteers, and our whole community.
Thanks for keeping KBOO strong.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It will be my pleasure to have on our program today Jessica Campbell, and she's the organizing director of Rural Organizing Project. For the last year, Jessica has been working with local leaders in rural and small town communities to respond to the growing militant and patriot movement. Last April, she worked with leaders in Josephine County to respond to an armed encampment at the site of a mining dispute near Grants Pass, organizing with leaders in Eugene in response to militants' attempt to recruit in the area, and has most recently been supporting local communities on the ground in Harney County. Thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Joanne.
It is my pleasure. And so I think everybody may know that there's an occupation going on, but just for the sake of for people who may have just moved here yesterday, would you tell our listening audience what's happening in Harney County right now?
Sure. Well, You know, it's been a couple of weeks now that there's been a small group of folks who are mostly from out of state who have taken the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and they are holding the buildings. They are armed to the teeth, and they're saying that they're going to stay there for years, despite the complaints of the vast majority of the community who lives there.
Now, we know that your local sheriff has been in communication with this group off and on over the last couple of weeks. Most of the public is just wondering, how is this even allowed to happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's really...
that is the question,
huh? ...their heads over right now. It really seems that there's a double standard. If you are a bunch of white guys with guns, there's a double standard that is, you know, there's a lot of folks who are not wanting to rush in there and cause any injury, because a lot of their talking points internally in the far right is if there's another Waco, that's going to be their opportunity to jump right in and continue building their movement. And that's really the cry. Don't let us be Waco'd. Let there not be another Waco.
Well, you know, it's interesting that they use the model of Waco, and I think about the MOVE model. Right. And the difference is in the melon count of the individuals that were involved.
Right.
And in fact, in the MOVE, they attacked when people were asleep. So very, very early in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and didn't mind blowing up a household with men, women and children in it. And so I guess because I'm a little older, I'm able to see before Waco, and so it makes me wonder, this is part of our history, when people organize against the government, in MOVE's case in Philadelphia, they were annihilated. The whole block was blown up, and they really didn't care how many people were killed. And so as we're looking at what's happening now in Harney County, we see that the police are taking a very hands-off approach, which in my mind is actually just emboldening people to be more outrageous and more aggressive. Is that what you're experiencing on the ground?
Well, you know, what's interesting on the ground, and this is part of what the media isn't capturing, which is really a travesty, is that there's the occupiers, which, you know, they're a group of folks that are a mishmash. Some are far-right Mormons. Others are patriots who are veterans, who are disabled and pissed off at the federal government. And then there's a whole other crew of paramilitary folks in town. So the refuge is 30 miles away from town, and in town there's groups called the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers who are armed to the teeth. And I mean, there's literally at least 200 of them in town, to the point where locals aren't even going to Bend. I mean, they're going to Bend 2.5 hours away in order to grocery shop because of all these other folks who are in town.
Jesse, I want to make sure people understand this. So when you in little small town and little small Harney County, there are people walking around with rifles that are off. They're not at the wildlife preserve, but they're just living in the community and walking around with highly armed.
They are booking entire hotels. They are taken over. There's two local hole-in-the-wall bars that locals normally love that they've more or less taken over. I mean, it is a really wacky situation where they are, you know, and vast majority of them are from out of state again, similar to the occupiers, to where the community just feels completely taken hostage. You know, the town of Burns is only, you know, just over 3,000 people. It is not a large community. So for there to be this huge influx of folks from out of state who are hungry for a conflict, it's changed the entire dynamic about how neighbors even interact with each other. You know, I've been there for a couple of weeks now, and when I arrived, it was incredibly warm and friendly. People were hollering at me on the street to stop and tell them where I'm from.
Right.
And when I left a couple days ago, It was to the point where no one's even making eye contact. They're not even talking to each other. It's really, really damaged how people are able to interact with each other. People are definitely feeling like they're walking on eggshells out there.
And so what is the sheriff's response and local law enforcement respond when the community members are fearful from just going about their day-to-day activities?
So I wish there was an easy answer. So the sheriff has been very vocal, and it's very clear he's been trying to go through the motions to really appear to be the best possible neighbor as possible to avoid any kind of situation where people could claim that he did not go through all of the steps he could have possibly gone through to try and end this, to the point of holding town halls where hundreds of people showed up, where everyone raised their hand saying, yeah, it's time for these people to get on out of here. He met up with them and said, the community said, and you said, when the community said, it's time for it to be over, you're going to split. So you're out of here now, right? But, you know, the other layer of it is that the sheriff at that huge town hall I described, it happened on the 6th, stood up and also talked about the threats and intimidation he's been facing and his family's been facing and his deputies have been facing for months and months, to the point where they're getting followed home. People are taking pictures of their children through their living room windows, people they don't recognize with out-of-state plates. And there's been a couple of really good pieces. One was by OPB on federal employees who have been receiving some of the same tactics and strategies. And then the Oregonian did one that really highlighted a couple of high school students who encountered some of the same kind of tactics. And, you know, this is really... It's really a play out of their playbook, which is a scary thing to think about. But, you know, it's been a situation for me since April, and certainly after July, it kind of kicked into overdrive where I had people showing up at my house, which is really hard to find. It is not on Google Maps. In the middle of the night at 3 in the morning, I've had the lug nuts of my car loosened. You know, it is very clear that these people who are, you know, in Burns right now have no problem trying to shut down any kind of dissenting voice, even if it means injuring people. It's a very scary situation on the ground, and the sheriff was even saying that his wife packed up and moved out of the county temporarily because she was so scared after having her tires slashed and after getting followed around. So,
Jessica, I'm just mind there. You're just blowing me away that this is actually happening and there doesn't appear to be an organized law enforcement response. I also saw the video of the sheriff having community meetings on the news and the entire room putting their hands up saying that they wanted people gone. They wanted their community back. And so I have to ask, where are the other elected officials? Especially, we have our congressional representative, Greg Walden, from that area. Have they shown any leadership in trying to end this occupation?
So Walden did speak out a couple, maybe it's about a week ago now, and he basically said, I disagree with the tactics, but the purpose is right on. So...
Yeah. We have a U.S. congressman saying that he agrees with them?
We sure do. It's to the point where as soon as these militia and paramilitary groups heard this, they started running around going, we have a congressman, we have a congressman.
So is he up for election this year, by the way?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't actually know.
I don't either, but we'll find out before this program's over. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Jessica Campbell, and she's with the Rural Organizing Project, and she's just blowing my mind about what's happening on the ground in Harney County. As you know, an occupation's been taking place for how long now?
Oh, it's almost into its third week. January 2nd.
It started January 2nd, and so today is the 21st. I have to say, it just boggles the mind to think that that this wasn't shut down immediately. And so it feels like that they've been encouraged by, especially if you got a U.S. congressperson saying, oh, yeah, we believe in the cause. Now, what I find fundamentally hard to understand is that from what I've heard directly from the mouths of the occupiers is that their goal is to take over the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
What we've heard a lot of is we want it dismantled.
So they want to dismantle the federal government, or they don't like the federal government as it
right.
is. That's not normally something that governments sit back and just allow to happen, right? I mean, if any other group, and this has been all over the web as well. When I first heard about it, I thought, oh, maybe Black Lives Matter should go take over a government building. Which building do we want, right? Because, if it's that easy, right, to take over a federal building, because normally when you take over a federal building, the weight of the federal government comes down on you. The fact that no weight has come down has actually emboldened these individuals and I believe given other people the idea that they too can go and take over a government building. What's to stop us all from doing that?
Totally. Well, and this is part of a pattern. They did this in April in Josephine County.
Right.
I mean, the Bundys weren't involved, but everyone else was. Same people. John Ritzheimer from Arizona, Blaine Cooper from Arizona. They were all out in Josephine County less than a year ago here in Oregon. And then in July, they hopped up over to a mine in Lincoln, Montana, did the same exact thing. They're showing up in Ferguson. I mean, it is a situation now where these folks feel totally empowered to just hop from place to place, creating a bunch of media spectacle, theater for the media,
right.
And they're fundraising hand over fist doing it. And they're recruiting for their movement as they do it.
Yes.
It's to the point where, something needs to be done, or we can continue to watch this pattern play out forever, probably.
Well, it's I have to say, it's a pretty scary visual to think of a bunch of big white guys with big guns walking up and down the street. I mean, that's a pretty scary thing to contemplate. I guess my next question is, there was a day of action that took place this week. I believe it was Tuesday or yesterday, where people rallied to say, we want these people gone. And I know that there were protests that happened all around the state. Was mm-hmm. that a successful effort?
Yeah, so it wasn't a rural day of action. There were a couple of days of action called by different enviro groups, and it sounded like I saw a lot of photos. It looked like there were some pretty fantastic gatherings out in Portland, Eugene, Bend. And then we had a couple of our groups do different actions as well, one out in LaGrant, and there's one coming up in Jackson County, I believe in Ashland, on this upcoming Saturday. So there's a lot of good stuff where people are really trying hard to go on record saying, the enviros, their message was really around public land means we all have access to it. That doesn't mean you get to hold yourselves up in it and keep it for yourselves and try to privatize it, which is part of their agenda. And then we have a whole slew of groups here at ROP and honestly across the country who are outraged that these people have come in to say that they're the voice of rural Oregon when they actually have no clue and they're distracting away from the real economic crises in rural Oregon right now. And it's not over, there's always been a real struggle over grazing fees and ranching, but right now, rural Oregonian communities need a new economic engine that isn't natural resource extraction. And that's the real conversation that we need to be having that's solution-based, not whether or not it's time for all of the public land to be turned over to corporations for mining, logging, ranching, whatever extractive process is going to go on there.
Right. I love the tribe's response originally. The local mm-hmm. tribe, I forget the name.
The Paiute tribe.
Yes, the Paiute tribe. It was phenomenal. Thank you so much. And by the way, we are the original owners.
Yep.
So
So if you get it, just turn it back over to us. We will be greatly appreciative. And so you're absolutely right, Jessica. So the issues that are really impacting rural communities are really not being addressed because people are so focused on the men with the rifles that mm-hmm. are occupying the wildlife refuge. And so the real issues that you're dealing with, which is high unemployment, a lack of resources to actually build in your community, what are you were going to list like the top three necessities in rural Oregon that are not being addressed, what would you say they are?
So I'm going to cheat.
Okay, cheat. It's okay.
I won't tell. Three. There is a real systematic, for 30 years, systematic destabilization and defunding of rural infrastructure to the point where there are communities in rural Oregon right now that you call 911
right.
and you get an answering machine. You don't get a human being. So, you know, that's really real.
That's and real,
when
yes.
I was sitting out in a town hall in Harney County last Monday, Monday before last, excuse me, folks were telling stories about how there was a fire that was going out of control and that folks actually had to get, you know, folks fundraised and got their own water trucks and had to put out fires to save their own property. So it's to the point now where rural Oregonians, if you don't have access to infrastructure, you better know how to fight fires, you better know how to handle medical emergencies, and you better know how to police yourselves, because otherwise you're not having access to any of that. And that's the real truth of the matter here in terms of the militia movement as well. We're in a situation where in Josephine County in April, it really exposed the fact that there were sheriff deputies that, you know, the call times in certain parts of the county was over 8 hours. And there was only one sheriff deputy on call at certain moments, and sometimes there weren't any. And that was true of Lane County, where I live as well. So, you know, it was a situation where we were talking with domestic violence workers who would go in with clients to get restraining orders against abusive exes. And the judge would say, I'm going to grant this, but you know there's no police right. Do you own a gun? To folks who are receiving these restraining orders.
Wow.
So these militia groups have really filled a niche in some of these communities that don't have access to police, don't have access also to, like, through the sheriff's department, there's all of the natural and man-made disaster response, typically. That's typically where that's housed.
Right.
And so if you have a defunded sheriff's department, you can't expect to get excavated from a mudslide that keeps you separated from town for 2 weeks unless it hits a certain priority level.
Right.
And similarly, if your police emergency isn't too extreme, they're not going to come. And these militia groups have come in and created their own infrastructure, which is a means of meeting people's desperate needs to have policing. I mean, people are desperate for that when you don't have it. It's very scary when you know you can't call the police to help you.
Right.
And then that's an entry point to their movement, which, of course, is thinly veiled white supremacy,
right.
and oftentimes not thinly veiled white supremacy, anti-queer, you know, anti-LGBTQ, anti-public lands, and all for privatization of every kind of stick and fiber in rural Oregon. It's a really a slippery slope, but they're starting off by meeting rural folks' really desperate needs, and that needs to not be kind of swept under the rug here. That's really the allure for a lot of communities right now. It's not their ideology that they're going for. It's for the basic infrastructure.
And so you've talked about the lack of public safety. There's not a public transportation system. The schools. Now, I have to ask about the schools, but the libraries. Are libraries public? Are they open? I know in some areas that they had mm-hmm. been closed and privatized. What are libraries?
Yeah. There's a lot of privatized libraries. Josephine and Jackson counties privatized all their libraries a few years ago, which is the largest library privatization in the history of the United States. And, you know, there's been some really hard-fought victories by folks in the Jackson County area to win their libraries back, but they're still private in Josephine County. And that's true. You know, post offices are a pretty major source of communication for folks that, you know, there's a lot of places in this state that don't have broadband internet.
Right.
So they're stuck on dial-up. And even dial-up on antiquated phone lines that haven't been maintained in decades is barely usable. I've been to communities where all they have is physical mail to communicate in and out with, to pay their bills with, because they can't even place a phone call. Their phone lines are so bad.
Oh, my. So you've thoroughly depressed me. I'm going to head to the phone line and see if maybe our callers can get me out of this funk. But again, I mean, knowledge is power, right? You are sharing information that we have not been able to get from any other sources. And so I am so appreciative that you're helping us educate folks about what's really happening on the ground. Because if you only listen to the newscast and you only read the news, the daily papers, or almost daily papers, or sometimes not quite daily papers. If you read only the papers, then you get a very narrow view of what's happening on the ground. So it's so vital to have someone who's right there to tell us what's going on. So we're going to go to the phone line. Hello, Brian. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
You need assistance.
Chris, good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
One thing that I did not hear discussed is the children out there in the Burns area.
Mm.
My kids actually go to school in Dayville, and apparently there are quite a few small local towns that have been letting the school children of Burns use their facilities for practice and games because they have been unable to have their own homecoming games on their own school because of the occupiers.
Wow.
So that was my two cents. I say keep it up. Nobody that I personally know in Eastern Oregon agrees with what they are doing. I haven't spoken with everybody, but everybody seems quite concerned about how this is going to end.
Well, I really appreciate you adding that component because we were ultimately going to get to the kids, but I'm glad you brought that piece in. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You do the same. Going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Don. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO. Hey, Don, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Welcome.
Hey, thanks for the Martin Luther King special. That was great.
Oh, you're very welcome. That was fabulous, wasn't it?
It was very informative. Hey, listen, your guest there, do you work for the government?
No, she is with the Rural Organizing Project, a grassroots nonprofit that works in rural Oregon, organizing people on issues that impact their lives.
Okay, so she doesn't receive any government funding or pay?
No, we don't.
No.
Okay, well, that's good. You know, because I kind of disagree with you a little bit, but first I do agree with you. The fact is, you look at MOVE, and when they dropped those army bombs, or brought in by the army, given to the mayor, Philadelphia, you know, they dropped them, and then the
street, that's right.
They were machine gunned down when they were running out of their house.
Right.
So it was really sick.
And the whole block was destroyed.
Yeah, it's really sick.
Yeah.
And I guarantee that's why they crashed that train, but we'll go there at some other time. Hey, and the other thing is, this land does belong to the Paiutes, and also, this side of the Cascades, let's remember, there was already a Mexican fort here before Lewis and Clark showed up, so maybe we're in the wrong place, too.
What did you mean about the Paiutes? What do you mean the land doesn't belong to them?
No, I said it does belong to
them. Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
I misheard you. Thanks.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But I'm just saying, even this side of the Cascades, a lot of people don't realize the Mexicans had already settled here.
That's right. That's right.
But anyway, hey, but here's where I disagree with you. You know, we're living in a society where our federal government especially has cameras, and they can look in your bathroom and your bedroom. They can watch everything you're doing. They can hear you from thousands of feet away. And so they have really come on really strong with their kind of equipment, invading our privacy as citizens. So it's the only place where I kind of agree with these guys is that the federal government has gone way too far. Same with our local law enforcement. And it's probably the only place where they do get a little sympathy from me in terms of stepping back and saying to all the federal employees, I realize a lot of them don't carry guns. A lot of them do a lot of great work. But, you know, they're all kind of in the same group, and so it's hard to have a lot of sympathy for people who are doing invading our privacy every minute. I heard Susan Bonamici the other day when she was talking about one of the riders on one of the appropriations bill that takes away more of our privacy. She said, well, you know, if there's a problem with surveillance, we'll fix it later. And that's kind of their attitude. So so I just wanted to offer that there's some of us who have a little bit of sympathy for them, even though their white privilege is pretty obvious. So thank you, guys.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you calling. And I think that all of us have some challenges with our federal government. The question mm-hmm. is, how do we respond to those challenges, right? Do we lobby them? Do we send them letters? Do we go testify? Or do we arm ourselves and take over some spot on the planet and declare it ours because the federal government hasn't treated us right? I mean, if there are many communities that have problems with the federal government, and I would put the African American community at the very top of that list, because we cannot trust the federal government to keep any of the promises that they have made over the generations. And so if anybody has a right to bear arms and take over a building, I don't think it's people who... I don't think it's these people. I don't think these people, and certainly they don't have any stake in what happens in Oregon. They should be in their own home community fighting the federal government on the way they think they should. That's a question for you, Jessica. So why did they pick Oregon? Just because we have federal lands, a lot of federal land? Jessica?
I think that that's probably a big reason why. Mm. You know, we go through circles
right.
trying to figure out why rural Oregon, right. why us? And, you know, honestly, last year when things were kicking off in Josephine County in April, the running theory was that it was a year after the Bundy Ranch standoff and that they were hungry for a reunion
mm-hmm.
to kind of keep the idea of this tactic alive. And, you know, it was kind of the same situation. They holed up around this mine. They went rah-rah for about a month, lost energy, lost steam. Same story out at the Bundy Ranch. And then kind of packed it in, and the government never pressed charges on any of them. And, you know, it seems like right now they were really wanting to jump in on the Hammond family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not been part of the story for a couple weeks now. But what kind of was the platform for this occupation to kick off was a march and rally that was organized by a coalition of paramilitary groups called the Pacific Patriots Network. And they were mostly out-of-state folks who decided that they wanted to come to Burns and have a rally and march around the Hammond family who, through, you know, it's really disputed a lot of the facts about what happened, but they were convicted under an enhanced anti-terrorism act. Which was passed after the Oklahoma City bombing and honestly has been used against, you know, lefty enviros and folks like that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But this time it caught a rancher who had accidentally, according to them, lit some BLM land on fire. And what ended up happening is that was prosecuted as arson of federal property. And the original judge sentenced them to a year and 3 months, 3 months to the older Hammond and a year to the younger Hammond,
right.
saying that the mandatory minimum of 5 years was too harsh. And the U.S. attorney went back and appealed that decision. And ultimately, they had to turn themselves in on the 4th to federal prison to finish out their mandatory minimum.
Right.
So, you know, it's a funny situation for a lot of people because there's a lot of folks who are against mandatory minimums, ROP included.
Exactly. Yeah. Same here, but it is interesting. But it was interesting that the Bundy family said that if the judge told them they had to go back to jail, that they were willing to turn themselves in and they would voluntarily do so. And they did voluntarily do that, right?
They sure did. They sure did. And they were publicly saying that they didn't want this rally in March to happen on the 2nd.
Right.
They just wanted to enjoy some quiet time with
before
their family.
Before they went
before
back
they
to jail.
To turn themselves in.
Right.
And, you know, these folks came storming in against the protests consistent protests by the community for them to leave them alone. And then, you know, the Bundys then broke off and did their thing, the occupation, and left the rest of the Pacific Patriots Network there looking mighty stunned and mighty angry that right. they had been lied to by the Bundys.
Right.
And the Pacific Patriot Network is now that group of folks that I described who are living in town, armed to the teeth. And they're pretending, they're playing this game, you know, it's all theater, trying to demonstrate that they're the reasonable ones, quote unquote, because they're trying to stake, they're trying to negotiate between the occupiers and the feds, in theory. It just seems like they're doing a lot of drinking in town, but nonetheless, that's what their stated purpose is. So, you know, it's a really complicated situation with a lot of people kind of at odds right now. But kind of the bottom line here is that they all came around this ranching family in a community where the community and the ranching family both said, don't come here. We don't want you here.
No, thank you, but no, thank you.
Here 3 weeks later.
I also read that one of the occupiers was devastated because they were removing foster children who mm-hmm. were in his care. And the newspaper quote was, "Well, that's my major source of income," and I. And so it left me with the question was, A, this gentleman was approved to be a foster parent. And that's mm-hmm. frightening to think that mm-hmm. that was so. And the question is now, actually, there's no question about that. That I just wanted to remind people that one of these people, in fact, made his livelihood off the government by taking in foster children. So it's kind of ironic to be mad at the federal government when he's actually living off the public trough.
Yeah, and you know, he's not just a guy who's out there. That's LaVoy Finicum. He's one of the main leaders.
He's one of the main leaders. Yeah, that's something's disturbing about that, right? And my understanding is that these kids get to work on his farm, right? Mm-hmm. Get the privilege of working on his farm. And it's ironic that he's here with a gun holding down the wildlife refuge while supposedly he was responsible for actually raising a group of kids. So
right.
it's one of those things that make you go, We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, John. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello. A little history, world history. Seems like this is spring 1917 or the Munich Beer Hall of 1923. You always have a small group of people, not always, but that seem to influence, and they go right in there and bogart everything, and they take over. Mm. I'm not saying this is kind of like a far-fetched what's going on here, but I had no idea that there were the promise keepers or whatever you call them.
Right.
These people got reinforced. So, you know, like in the early days of
I thought
Adolf,
the Promise Keepers were a religious group. Right?
Okay.
That's a different group.
Okay, but somebody, Oath Keepers, whatever they were
yeah,
called.
Yeah, 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 okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But, you know, like just knowing a little bit of history, how, you know, Adolf got it, the power.
Yes.
I mean, he was nothing but just a, you know, little clown at first. But, you know, when economic times and stuff started to get really worse, he became more appealing.
Yes.
And, you know, you look at the whole thing, how Donnie Trump is getting away with all his little potty mouth.
Yes.
And stuff like that. And then you have 47 million people on food stamps. I mean, I have some really sick situation that this will catch on fire as the economy gets worse and worse. These people are going to be more attractive to, you know, whatever, very poor people.
See, that's my fear. My fear is that as the economy continues to only benefit the filthy wealthy in our community, that poor people who are on the edges are going to be very attracted to groups like this occupying force in Harney County. And that is my biggest fear. And because we know that these groups, some of them are racist and sexist and homophobic and et cetera, et cetera. And then what you just brought up, and which is a great point, Donald Trump has given permission for this nastiness to become the norm. And so you add the nastiness to rifles, and all of a sudden you've created a life-threatening situation for people who aren't white, male, and middle class.
Well, it always comes from the extreme right. I mean, whatever you want to call it, extremism.
Right.
Whether it be, maybe Lenin wasn't really what you call a real right-winger, but then again, you know, at that time he was, you know, considered, he was, you know, what you call bucking the system.
Right.
So it always comes from the right. You know, I just by this little exposure I've seen by how, you know, revolutions start, et cetera, it comes from the extreme right, whether it's, you know, like in Central America or, you know, Eastern Europe, you know, like Ukraine, you know. Those people are Nazis that are going over there. So, I mean, the United States, you know, right now is in decline. And so this just shows you one little bookmark or what's going on.
Well, I think this gives us a warning on what's to come. I think it's kind of a preview of what we can expect as long as Donald Trump becomes the norm of politics in the United States of America.
Norm, or he becomes the president.
Oh, no, if he becomes the president, I'm gone. You heard it here first. I'm out of here. If he's president, I'll be back in 4 or 8 years, depending. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay,
appreciate
bye.
It. Have a good day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I am talking to Jessica Campbell. She's with the Rural Organizing Project, and she has been educating us on what life has been like in Harney County for the people who live, pay taxes, work, go to school, worship in that community, and what is happening now that it's occupied by people from other parts of the United States. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Carrie. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
I just recently purchased a book, Dark Money. Jane Meyer, she is a columnist for The New Yorker. And the reason I purchased this is because she actually made the mention in this article in The New Yorker that the Koch brothers and the Americans for Prosperity were funding a lot of these kinds of groups. And I just pulled up an article, the New York Times, that suggests that there is a Utah-based group that is behind this and also being funded by the Koch brothers. So I'm curious what your take is on that, if you've heard anything about this.
Jessica?
If you've read the book.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of folks who have been trying to dig into the money behind this, and so far Koch brothers haven't come up, so I'm curious what the name of that company is or that organization is. You know, we're in a moment where the Bundys are kind of independently wealthy. They have their own fundraising base now around what they're doing, so that's where some of their energy is coming from. And then certainly groups like the Oath Keepers, you know, they're the largest patriot group in the country, and they have a $4 million budget, which some people scoff at and other people gasp at. But as someone who works at a very small organization, we gasp at it. Because
but you were like, oh, what I could do with $4 million, right?
It would be incredible. And none of that money has been linked back to Koch brothers. That's been a big question. Is there like a bogeyman that we can point at to say, look, here's who's pulling the strings here?
Yes.
And that's been one of the hard things for us to find. Do you happen to have the name of that organization?
Actually, I don't see it in scanning the article right now, but it is a New York Times article by Jack Healy on January 10th. The title is Larger But Quieter Than Bundy Push to Take Over Federal Land.
Well, thank you.
It does mention the Americans for Prosperity and the
Oath Keepers.
Name of the individual is Mr. Ivory, Ken Ivory, a Republican state representative from Utah. And that's all I've really had a chance to scan on. I was just curious if you had heard more about that. It was a very interesting connection to me.
Well, thank you so much. I had not heard that. I have a young man here that's training with me that has a question. Go ahead, Jared.
Hi, my name is Jared Dantzler. I'm really glad, thank you, caller, that you brought up dark money, and Amy Goodman does a lot of reporting on this in the past couple mm-hmm. days, linking the Koch brothers and their right-wing agenda and the money that's spent to influence campaign elections.
Exactly.
She reveals in her research that the Koch brothers spend more money than the entire official Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. You can thank Citizens United for that ability, right? Thank mm-hmm. our U.S. Supreme mm-hmm. Court for making money free speech. And the more money you have, the more free speech you get.
They're challenging so many things in our Supreme Court right now. I guess the public sector, unions
unions.
Being funded, they're behind that funding as well.
There's a lot of scary stuff on the U.S. Supreme Court's agenda. That's absolutely true. And whether it's choice, whether it's affirmative action, which may disappear, this court, I mean, there's a lot of things on their agenda that we would prefer they not deal with at all, because we don't see good things coming out of this Supreme Court. Thank you for your call.
How can the Supreme Court, kind of attend these meetings even? Anton Scalia was, and Clarence Thomas were even in their meetings. It's kind of frightening. But thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate the discussion.
Well, I appreciate you as well. You have a fabulous day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And back to the phone line. Good morning, Francis. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. I didn't realize how much these people were intimidating the local people who live in Burns. And that's really not
I didn't
even
either.
Cool.
That's why I'm glad we're talking to Jessica.
you mentioned the Native, the Tribal Federation there. One of the women who was a leader there spoke quite a couple weeks ago, I believe.
Quite eloquently, when she did.
Yes, and talked about how they were violating sacred land. And if we wanted to talk about who the land really belonged to, we could do that.
Right.
And also one of the men who was with her said that if we had taken up arms like that, we mm-hmm. would be dead now,
yep.
and that is
right.
pretty much true. And I'm trying to figure out what the difference is between these people and any other group or organization who decided they wanted to take back some land. Is it just because they're white privileged men that they're able to do this? Where's the police?
Yep. It appears to be. I mean, I can't come up with any other answer other than the fact that
nobody else would be able to do this.
No, that's right. Well, you may have been listening earlier, and I said I'd love Black Lives Matters to work and figure out what government building
right.
we want to take over, right? Because
right.
we
yeah.
should be able to do it. If
and
they
can
do it, we should be able to do it.
One official said early on that they're in an isolated area. They can't really do any damage there. And I thought, who else would get to do that anyway?
Right.
Nobody.
Well, that's still somebody's local community.
Right.
It's still a reserve that the community supports. And so, yeah.
It sounds like the local people are not, they're harassing them. That's not a good thing. Where are the authorities? I don't know where the authorities are. This is crazy.
Well, the sheriff...
What's it? Interesting about the occupiers is that they keep on escalating
yes.
what they're doing out there at the
right.
refuge. It's not just like
nobody's
they're twiddling their thumbs.
Them.
They're cutting roads. They're cutting fences. They just cut a fence that was supposed to protect some Paiute artifacts and just bulldozed
right
up, road right through it yesterday.
Okay. So where's our authorities?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
it.
The question. It seems like they're escalating
right.
asking for it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, you guys take care, and thank you for what you do.
You too, Francis. Thank
Bye-bye.
You for the call. And so Francis did raise an interesting point. Have the government cut power to this location? Have they turned the heat off? Have they made this the most miserable environment possible for occupiers to be in?
No. No, the roads are completely open. They have press conferences every morning at 11 a.m. Anyone can drive up there. I drove up there myself a few times. I mean, it's to the point where people are really comparing it. There's this group called the Freeman out in Montana.
Yes.
And they did a similar standoff. And what the feds actually did is they cut off the roads. They
right.
cut the power and they starved them out. It took 81 days.
Right.
But there wasn't a shot fired. And
right.
those people went straight into police custody. And we're seeing none of that here. You know, they have power. They're using the government computers and accessing files that include sensitive information about the federal employees there who are already getting death threats. I mean, is this a really bizarre situation? Why not cut off the internet? Why not cut off the phone lines
yes.
that they're using?
And so on this point, I want to make sure, Jessica, that you give us some concrete things that the listeners of this program can do to support the people in Harney County. Do you have a list of asks for us?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of great things happening. You know, in Harney County, there's a lot of folks who are really trying to figure out how to keep their lives going. And part of what we're doing is we've reached out to the folks at the hospital there, and they're having a fundraiser that's a masquerade ball on the 6th. Tickets are $8, and it benefits cancer. And, you know, Marcy Westerling was the founder of ROP, and she passed away in June from a you know, over 5-year fight with ovarian cancer. And so we've really been connecting the dots between just what our founder went through mm-hmm. with what the local community is going through, where they have to keep postponing their fundraiser to support local cancer patients
right.
Because of what's going on. So that's one very concrete way that you can support folks there locally. Honestly, you know, there's a lot going on, but there's a number of projects there locally that are hurting for dollars. And while there's plenty of organizations from outside of Harney County who are begging for funds right now, you know, there's kids who want buildings and need buildings for their activities to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the best thing that could happen for the community right now is there to be such a surge in pressure that this ends. So
right.
if that is, you know, there's any way that folks are willing to write letters to the editor or call into radio shows or whatever it may be to really raise the fact that folks are being threatened, folks are being intimidated. School wasn't even in session for a week, which meant folks couldn't actually work because they had to take care of their kids.
Right.
You know, it's really right. severely impacting the lives of folks on the ground here. And unfortunately, it isn't making it into the media, but that is something that we could do individually that really makes a difference. To really start to change that narrative and make it very clear that, you know, the media is reporting this as a conflict. The community is divided. And the community isn't divided.
No.
Sure, they have a couple of supporters,
right.
but everyone I've spoken to, at least 95% of the community, is ready for these folks to leave their community alone so they can get back to their lives. And that's the bottom line here.
So do you think it would be helpful to have people also call the county sheriff? Because it's federal land, so I'm not sure who you'd have to call to shut the power off, to shut the electricity off, to do away with the internet service. But we should find out who in the federal government should be getting those phone calls. And then I will post that on my Facebook page. I've also posted the Rural Organizing Project's website on my Facebook page that has information that you can use as you're writing your letters to the editor or making phone calls to local elected leaders saying, you know, you need to do something because if I no. What I was about to say was I was going to say, okay, so you can either stop this or you can expect 10 Black Lives Matter takeovers in the next week. But that sounds like a threat, so I don't want to say that. But the thought occurred to me that that would be something to make them stand up and take notice. But we should be calling the elected officials and saying, at a minimum, you should not be making it easy for them to be on that property.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're not paying power bills, if they're not paying light bills, then they shouldn't have any. It's as simple as that. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Kevin. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to what Jessica said about the whole issue of Enroll Oregon, about the citizens there calling 911 and going to a voicemail.
Yes.
Yeah, so here's the thing about these people, the militia groups. They're advocating for these lands, these federal lands, these BLM lands, to go back to county level of ownership. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, this is the whole disparity that's crazy. And people, like the people of this nation don't understand that. I mean, these counties aren't managing some of their resources very well, especially in regards to, I mean, what Jessica just said, 911.
Right.
You call 911 at certain times, and you get voicemail. So how can we expect, like, counties to manage these vast majorities of lands? I mean, they didn't want to manage these lands. They were happy that the federal government took these lands.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the whole thing. This people in this nation, especially conservative voters, don't really understand what's going on municipal level, county level, and federal level. They just want federal governments to get out of the counties and these municipals' businesses.
Exactly.
But what's happening is that the county is happy that they're giving the lands to the federal level. And, I mean, it's just that Jessica just brought up a good example that they're not really able to manage so many things too well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
There's the layers, certainly. I totally agree with you that there have been multiple counties that have gone on record saying, and, you know, that's part of the theater that these occupiers are engaging in right now. They're saying, well, if this goes over to the county level, then the counties can decide what happens to it. But what would actually happen, as you pointed out, is that the counties don't even have basic infrastructure under their belts, and it's not just because of mismanagement. You know, there's been a systematic defunding of rural for decades. That's also at play here, that is structural as well. But nonetheless, these counties don't have the infrastructure to be able to manage these lands, which means that they would immediately be opened up to privatization. They would immediately be opened up to the mining, logging, and ranching. That's their mantra out there. You know, so that's you know, it's a thinly veiled privatization agenda that they're engaging in right now. They're saying it would go under control of the counties, but as you pointed out, you know, many counties are really appreciative that federal agencies are bottom lining the management of that.
And so, Jessica, I'm curious as to how would you respond when people say that Harney County and other rural counties receive significant federal benefit over decades, and so didn't feel the need to do the infrastructure rebuilding necessary because they were so reliant on this federal payment that was coming in. It wasn't until, and it's now gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I suspect that there are people that are saying that your government failed the people because they knew those timber payments were coming to an end. They knew that they had to find additional resources, and they knew that for about a decade before it actually happened. How would you respond to that?
You know, that's real. I live in rural southern Lane County, and that is a common conversation of folks in the coffee shop. And it's true, you know, counties did know that these payments were going to run out, and there have been some stopgap funding passed to kind of maintain basic layers of infrastructure. But the bottom line is that there's no economic engine in many of these communities other than natural resource extraction, and there hasn't been any investment in order for that to happen. And, you know, couple that with the fact that there's been systematic defunding of programs and, you know, mental health resources. Many places in the state, you have to travel hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles to access mental health resources.
Wow.
how scary is that if you think about
that is very scary.
How many veterans there are. Like Harney County, I heard someone say that is almost 10% veterans, which is really high.
Right.
And if you have to drive hours to get mental health resources,
yes.
That's not a scary get them. Situation.
Right.
And, you know, that's not county funding. That's right. Federal funding in that bucket, in that boat there. So
that's
there's
right.
just, you know, been a lot of years of neglecting rural.
Yes.
And our own legislature has been, you know, complicit with that in the last few years here.
Right.
And we're hitting a point here where we're going to have to say, no, we need to have some bottom lines for rural communities. Like you call 911 and you actually get a person.
That's right.
You know, that should be a fundamental right of living here.
And Jessica, we're going to end on that note. Thank you so, so much. If something significant happens, I will bring you back. Because I so appreciate you being able to give us real information from the ground that we're not getting from anywhere else. So thank you so, so much. Also, if we find out who the federal agency is that's supposed to shut off the power, we will post that on our Facebook page. This has been Joanne Hardesty. It's been a pleasure. See you next week, same time, same place, same station. Thank you, my fabulous engineer, Steve. See you later. Bye.
Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light.
And good morning. It is 1 minute in front of 9 o'clock on your Thursday, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. In a half hour at 9:30, join us for Fight the Empire. Host Per Fogring speaks with Michael Clare about his article, There Will Be Chaos, Big Oil's Collapse and the Birth of a New World Order. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an interview with activist Morning Star of the International Treaty Council on her concerns about Native Indian burial sites and ancient artifacts at the wildlife refuge outside Burns. Also, violence in Haiti in the wake of tainted elections and massive protests, and an update from Michigan on the water poisoning disaster. At 11, host David Naiman speaks with Keith Lee Morris about his novel Traveler's Rest, and at 11:40, it's a special Words and Pictures with the directors of the animated feature The Box Trolls, the third feature from Oregon animation studio Leica Entertainment. That's all coming up this morning right after Press Watch. It's news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell right after this.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running through